agus fáteach thí le rasca Gaelic song stories, an podchrúlach far an bimise dír de ghríamach a tuirst súl ar na scéalachan ar cúlamh na náran. Hello and a very warm welcome back to the final episode in this series of Gaelic song stories with me, Deirdre Graham. Throughout this podcast series, I've looked at more stories and themes behind Scottish Gaelic songs. As a Gaelic singer myself, I have a lifelong affinity with the songs and stories that surrounded me growing up, which have been transmitted through the oral tradition and more recently in recordings and collections. These stories echo across the Highlands, and as I've delved into them, I've wanted to take you on a journey to explore the Scottish Gaeltacht and highlight the continuing relevance of these songs. I have had the great fortune of interviewing some wonderfully knowledgeable guests, each of whom have a keen interest and expertise in several different areas, including war, piping and political struggles, and each with a good smattering of humour. Kim Carney has been described as having a voice with velvet-voiced authority, but she also has a keen interest in all things morbid. And in this final episode, I'm excited to have found someone who is equally as curious into the bloody world of Gaelic murder as I am. Throughout our conversation, we share a couple of beautiful songs, both with a harrowing backstory, and revel in the gruesome details. Despite the topic, we had a lot of fun, too much fun, getting our heads around some of the details that emerge from life in the 16th and 17th century. And so, without giving too much away, I give to you the last in this second series of Gaelic song stories, O Murcht. Hello, Kim. Hello.
This is it. Deirdre, lovely to be here with you.
Why don't you lead us, Kim? Hello, Kim. Thank you so much for agreeing to chat to me today. It's a total delight to have you on Gaelic Song Stories.
Oh, the delight is mine.
So now that our niceties are out of the way, let's get heavy.
Yeah. Straight into bloody murder.
Straight into, exactly. I was going to ask you, have you ever listened to the podcast My Favourite Murder?
Yeah, I love that podcast.
I was kind of hoping we'd be on the same page for this.
Yeah, it's when you tell people you listen to that, they're like, oh, that's quite weird, but actually it's funny and you learn something.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think it's like disrespectful.
No.
It's a curiosity.
It is, yeah.
That needs explored.
Yeah, people love it.
They do. There's I was reading something actually that says that women in particular are more fascinated by murder.
Which is interesting because they tend not to be the murderers. But I wonder if that's why. Yeah. Because
maybe
you think, oh, well, there's maybe a chance that I'll be murdered one day. You know, I personally don't think that. But, you know, like that podcast, My Favourite Murder, it's about times people were almost murdered. And it's always women that are writing in. It's like, oh, that's really creepy and quite interesting.
It is. And apparently part of the fascination and the passing on of stories of murder is to prepare yourself. It is as a preventative measure.
Yeah. Learning from other women. So creepy. It's but great.
Great. And Gaelic's no exception.
No, there's so much murder.
So much murder. And not only is there murder, but we love to sing about it.
I know. There are, in that way as well, there's loads of songs of warning.
Yeah.
It's a really cool part of the tradition.
It's really cool, especially when you've got a tradition that is an oral tradition. Mm-hmm. That's passed on through songs and stories. Kind of It's a beautiful way to pass on something quite heavy, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Yeah. A good way to ingrain you from a young age. Yeah. In fact, the youngest age, because we're going to be talking today about a lullaby, mm-hmm. As well as a lament.
Yeah, the lullabies are so dark.
So dark.
Yeah.
I said that to somebody recently. I was like, talking about lullabies and how often I view them as a form of kind of processing grief, mm-hmm. and that they're really dark and they have some... They looked at me horrified. Like, what lullabies have you been singing?
Like, every Gaelic lullaby that exists, I'll have you know.
Exactly.
But do you know that way I was speaking to a good friend of ours? She noticed that all the Gaelic songs were just so dark and about death. And then she was writing one herself and she realised that she was writing about her own fears, about her own daughter growing up. And she's like, it's a mother thing. Like, all you do is, like, fear for your child's life, or... Like, you just love them so much that you're just like, okay, let me protect them, so let me warn them, or let me get my fears out about motherhood. And she found herself in the position that hundreds of thousands of Gaels have done before, and women across the world.
Yeah, absolutely, women across the world. I was reading an article about lullabies, kind of folk lullabies, not the lullabies that we think of. The sweet, loving, and of course there are sweet, loving, nurturing lullabies as well. But there are some really, really heavy lullabies from examples from Japan and Italy, and they all have these kind of common threads in them. And I think something else in common with them is you have a woman who is very vulnerable with a young child, sleep deprived, perhaps up through the night trying to lull the child needs lulled when it's distressed. Mm-hmm. And you're not going to be singing these songs to soothe it when it's happy playing.
Yeah.
You know, where you're in a very vulnerable state. And so a lot of kind of... And very lonely as well, because it tends to be just the mother with the child by themselves. No audience, so nobody judging what's being said, and you can express your darkest thoughts.
Yeah.
And I find that incredible that at some point that's been transmitted to an audience, whether it was maybe overheard or whether the mother has confided with a song, however it has become transmitted into the oral tradition.
Lullabies are also one of the only forms of writing that women were allowed to do for... Mm-hmm. centuries, that they were only allowed to sing working songs and lullabies. They were banned from singing anything else, and there's so many examples of that. Probably the most famous, like Maire Nín Ealas Do Ruaidh. Like, so it's lullabies in our tradition is some of the only way that we have an insight into how women were feeling and what they were dealing with in the world from their perspective. They're very, very powerful songs.
Very powerful, yeah. Yeah, it's the loveliest thing as well, since, you know, when song collectors started going around and transcribing these songs and work songs and lullabies and women's songs, that you realise this whole other world, aside from the kind of bardic poetry, the men's realm.
Yeah.
And it does, I think powerful is the right word, and just what's been carried through the oral tradition for hundreds of years.
Yeah.
And it's a support network. I always think of these women's songs as like support for each other.
Mm-hmm.
And a safe space to kind of share some pretty dark thoughts, and not even just dark thoughts. We're talking specifically about lullabies at the moment, but personal responses to real events, which we'll get into.
Yeah.
I think it's like, I feel terrible for laughing. I'm not laughing at any of the events we're about to talk about.
No, not at all. But it's a funny thing to be talking about in an afternoon, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. With our cups of peppermint tea.
Yeah, totally.
So today, what I would love for us to do is we've chosen a song each. Mm-hmm. And the songs that we have chosen are kind of linked. There are similarities between them, but there are differences, and they both have really, really gruesome stories. And I'd love it if we got just roller sleeves up and got stuck right into them.
I don't know what it says about us that we've chosen two songs of beheadings.
I think I might need to put a trigger warning at the start of this.
Do you know someone who was beheaded? Stop listening.
Oh, no. But yeah, keep going.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Do you want to go first?
Yeah.
Okay. I feel like Cilla Black from the, remember the programme Blind Date? Would you remember Blind Date?
No. Was she the ginger lady?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And she had the dating show and way off on a tangent. But she would have three people behind a screen and her catchphrase was, "What's your name and where'd you come from?" And I kind of feel like, "What's your song and what's its story?"
Great. I feel like she dressed quite like glamorously.
She had
shoulder pads. We need to get you some velvet for your podcast. And we'll just describe it to the audience. You should see her right now. She's so lush. So the song that I chose was Mushna Kippi, which is probably one of the kind of more known beheading songs that we have. And this song itself, there's a few versions of this song. There's two by Ian Thelm, who is an incredibly well-respected bard and very, very smart man from Lochaber. And his two were Mushna Kippi itself, so the Kippach murders, and Kua the Vachki Hrel in a Kippi is Ivrahid, nice and catchy. And then there's a third, which is also called Mushna Kippi, written from the sister's perspective. Sometimes it's called Kua Nian Ichgrel, but I call it Mushna Kippi because it's a catchier title. But the songs tell the story of many graphic murders that happened back in 1663. Mm-hmm. So the stories follow two brothers, so there's Alistair and Ruel, and they had been sent to France to study, to finish their education. Mm-hmm. And in their absence, their father had passed away. And before the boys came home, while in that interim space, their father was the clan chief. Mm-hmm. Their uncle stood in his place.
McDonald's of Kippach.
So the father was called Thald Glass, and he was the clan chief. I think maybe the 11th or the 12th clan chief. Okay. And his brother, Alistair Buye, stood in place. And when the brothers came home for the son, Alistair, to take over, the uncle wasn't delighted about this. Mm-hmm. And we don't quite know why there was such a kind of hard feelings towards the brothers, but there is a couple of ideas. And I suppose through oral tradition, we have a good idea of the political scene at that time within the clan and kind of across Scotland itself. There's one suggestion that the ill feelings towards the brothers started off pretty much as soon as they were born, because their father, Thald Glass, he had actually married twice, which was obviously, that just didn't happen back then, and or if it did, not often, especially not of a clan chief. And his first wife had passed away, but they didn't have any sons.
So the sons were from the second marriage?
Yeah.
Okay.
And she was from the south, although I'm pretty sure the south was Stirlingshire, but still south.
The Gaeltacht.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So that wasn't in keeping with what that usually you marry within the clan.
Alistair Buye, Douglas's brother, would have felt perhaps a more legitimate claim to...
He certainly felt that, and a lot of people in the clan felt like that too. So there had... It said that there was that ill feeling from very early on in the brothers' lives. But when they came back from France, there was also said to be a feeling that they had picked up some French manners that weren't quite in keeping with how the clan liked to behave.
Wow.
And it was thought that they were maybe a little bit arrogant too. They were well educated because they were sent away. So I suppose at that time, although people were incredibly smart, most people at that time couldn't read or write, especially not in Highlands. Yep. So these boys were maybe came back thinking they were a little bit better. We don't know. This is kind of some accounts that have been passed down for hundreds of years.
And there's perhaps a mixture of the two.
Totally. And there's varying accounts of the moments that led up to the murders of these brothers themselves. So there's one account, for example, that says that the MacDonalds of Inverlair were at the castle of the brothers for dinner, either as a celebration of him taking Alistair taking over or of them returning home, and they didn't like the manners and they killed them there and then at dinner. That's one account.
Okay.
But there's also, but the story that we know from Ian Laum and from the sister is that it was said that there was at least 30 men who came in to their home one night while the boys were sleeping, and they were unarmed, and they, Alistair, the older brother, heard a commotion, so he went towards the entrance of the castle, and he was held down, and they started to stab him.
Oh.
And by the sounds of Ian Laum's accounts, he had hacks out of him everywhere. And the younger brother heard the commotion, so he started to come towards the group of men and try to save his brother. Now, this isn't a widely accepted account, but there is a story of the younger brother, Ruth, saw his uncle, and he shouted for his uncle's help as he was watching his brother be murdered. Now, the story goes that the uncle took steps towards the younger brother and took the first stab into his chest. Now, Ian Laum must not have thought that to be the case. Ian Laum was the bard of Keppoch's at the time. He was an incredible, incredible man. He was, again, some people think he was highly educated, but also a lot of people believe that he couldn't read or write himself. But he had incredible knowledge of politics at the time, clan history, Scottish history. I think he could probably recite the Bible. Like, he knew all of the kind of, like, pre-Christianity customs, but also, and the history that followed up, but also Christianity itself. And apparently he had quite a lot of sway over the Jacobite leaders at the time too, and bards, so many bards had huge influence, culturally and politically. They still play a part in our lives, because it's through them that we know so much of the history that we know. So he took it upon himself to avenge the deaths of these brothers. And he wrote Moisne Kepi, one of his versions, and he also wrote the second one with that catchy title. And in that second one, in the latter, he mentioned the names of those who he believed were responsible for the murders. Wow. So he named, I think there's seven names, and two of them were the sons of Alistair Buye, so it would be the cousins.
Yeah.
And then one of the MacDonalds from Inverlair, which happens to be the guys from the dinner party, his brother, and three locals, which were all from that area. So actually, to be fair, the dinner party thing could have, we don't know, but there is maybe hints of why they believed that, because it was them who were present at said dinner party.
Some dinner party. Watch out, folks, if you're hosting a dinner party.
Yeah, exactly. But these are all parts and anecdotes of different stories and accounts, so we can't be sure of the lead up to it, but what we can be sure of from Ian Laum's compositions is we know how it ended for these guys.
Not well.
So he apparently he actually had to leave Lochaber when he first composed these pieces, because the clan were so angry with him for saying that it was Alistair Buye's sons. And also the brothers weren't particularly popular. For some people they were, but there was certainly that ill feeling towards them for various reasons. And a lot of people did agree with Alistair, that Alistair Buye should have been the clan chief. So there was that kind of torn feeling within the clan. And so the clan themselves didn't want to do anything about this murder. They didn't want to help Ian Lom, and so he went to the neighbouring clan. They didn't want anything to do with it either. So he eventually went to the Privy Council, and he told them what happened, and he listed the seven men who he thought were responsible for these deaths, and they said, "Fire and sword, you can kill them. That's, you can avenge these deaths of the brothers." So he got help from I think it was McDonald's up in Slate.
My neighbours.
Yeah, yeah. And so they came down. And
yeah, he had a very close kinship with them, McDonald's of Slate.
Yeah.
He wrote some praise poetry for Dol Coramog. Was it Dol Coramog?
I don't know.
We can cut that bit.
Oh, it probably is. I just don't know.
I think it was.
I will cut this.
Okay.
Sorry. I'm like, I don't know, Judy. Sounds right.
Could have been.
There's so many Dol Coram.
So many.
I'm like, God, there's so many colours with these men.
Yeah.
I actually think one of the cousins was called like Alistair Jerak in this as well. There's all sorts.
Painting a rainbow.
Yeah, exactly.
So, sorry, we digress. So, Ian Lom.
So he got help from the McDonald's
Slate.
Yep, and they came down, and it was said that Ian Lom only guided them to the site where the men were. However, if you were to read the songs or listen to the songs, it's definitely a first-hand account of the murders.
So I was a little bit confused about this because there's another song that Ian Lom is particularly well known for, La Inverlochy, the Day of Inverlochy, and that commemorates a huge battle that Ian Lom witnessed. He apparently climbed a tree instead of he was offered a sword and he refused the sword because in his previously, I don't know how young he was, he'd accidentally killed his brother in battle. And from then on he said he would never brandish a sword again. So when it came to La Inverlochy, he climbed a tree and he said to, I think it was Alistair McCullough, who appears in many other songs, it's so interconnected.
It's like the Instagram of the day.
Yeah.
all these influencers.
But he had said, no, you fight and I'll write. So basically, you know, I will, who'll compose who the poetry and who will be able to commentate on the events.
Well, so. it could have been then that he had no hand in it, but it sounds like he certainly witnessed it. But he wasn't, I don't know if he was quite meant to be there. I don't think he was to be responsible for the executions, probably for that reason, that he didn't ever want to hold a sword. However, it is said that when the McDonald's of Slate came down, they found these seven men and they killed them. It is said that Ian Lom beheaded them with, apparently, the dirks that killed the brothers.
So maybe he didn't...
kill them.
Maybe he didn't have a sword again.
He had a dirk.
But he had a dirk. Well, that's where his models lay.
Yeah. Big difference.
Yeah.
Yeah. So then with these bodies, he tied the heads together with heather and he threw them over his shoulder and he took them to, well, they actually went on a wee bit of a journey, but he did on his way to Edinburgh and, well, first to Invergarry, he stopped at what is now known as Topernikion, which is on Loch Oich, and which translates as the well. Well, actually, it's the well of the seven heads, but the well of heads. And he washed them there, which I think was custom.
Okay.
When you beheaded someone, you were to wash them.
Polite.
Yes. And then he took them to the neighbouring clan, lay out the heads, because their chief apparently failed to seek these boys out. So he did the job for them, basically. And then some of them, apparently their heads ended up in Edinburgh.
On the Royal Mile? No, Leith Walk.
Was it Leith Walk?
Leith Walk.
Yeah. I don't know, as a kind of warning, I suppose, as they did that. Yeah,
I believe so. I pass that loch a lot.
Of course.
When I'm driving between Skye and Glasgow. It's so beautiful. It's
it's gorgeous.
Gorgeous spot. And there's a monument that commemorates the Tóipín an Ghearán.
Yeah.
As well.
Yeah, and at the top there's the seven head, like it's gorgeous. Yeah. Like they've done a good job. But also although we can't be sure of certain facts and there's varying accounts, what we can be certain of is apparently in the 1900s they dug up the grave and they found seven skeletons with no skulls, which confirms the death.
With no skulls?
No skulls, yeah, because they were obviously beheaded. But funnily enough, Ian McFarlane of Glenfinnan, he was telling me a story about this last year, and he said that apparently when Ian Laum had them all tied together with heather over his shoulder, the heads were knocking together. And he shouted back to them saying oh, you didn't get on in life and now you're still knocking heads in death. Oh, I hope it's true.
I do. That's brilliant.
Yeah. It is great. There's also a place in Lough Aber called Toran na Mian, which is Hill of the Oath, or Hill of Oaths. And the men who killed the brothers were said to have left the murder site, gone there and made an oath with each other that they would never tell anyone of anybody's involvement. And now that's called the Hill of Oaths.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I'd like to go there.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what it is?
It's Glenroy.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But there's that whole area of Lough Aber. There's a monument for Ian Laum.
Uh-huh.
He's buried. Well, they don't know quite whereabouts he's buried. But
there's a monument for him that Charles Fraser Mackintosh, the MP, put up for him, isn't there?
But apparently it was put up originally in the wrong place. I don't know if they ever moved it. But he was said to have asked to have been buried facing his home village, and everybody else was the opposite facing. I can't remember what it was, but he apparently was asked to be buried facing home, which is...
That's quite nice.
It is quite nice, isn't it?
Poetic.
The other version of the song is from the sister's perspective, and she walked in the morning and saw all of the blood of her brothers. And it's just about her pain and her fury at the situation. And there's a strong line in the song that says, "Carshin gave hain, brad and gossiat," and it's so they were your kin and they were my brothers. And it's mm-hmm. really, really painful mm-hmm. song, but gorgeous. It's so,
really beautiful.
Yeah, chobarshel. But
there's another line in it. I don't have the words to. To hand, but you know them about the blood,
mm-hmm.
and was that in Ian Laum's version or in the sister's version or both?
Both, I think. Yeah, so it's definitely in the sister's version, but I'm sure it's in one of Ian Laum's versions. So it's Hanig ur fulh hart mavrok, and so your blood came over my shoes.
Like just that idea of it kind of gushing forth.
Yeah, it is a really. The song is really descriptive and it's gory. It is really mm-hmm. gory. And then the next line is Hannah could feel the heart of a rock and it's chill noch dull mehin melodi. So it's like they're pretty much saying that they drank as much. Yeah, drank as much as she could. Yeah. Which is disgusting. Absolutely minging.
But just to be said that straight, we do not condone that.
But that was a thing where women were said to have done that.
Yeah, this is something that struck me, and it will come up in the song I've chosen as well, that this seemed to be a ritual that women in kind of keening songs and lamentation, would express the desire to kind of drink the blood of someone who had been kind of brutally murdered. Seems to have been fairly common.
Yeah, it's...
Which I had never heard this before until I was looking at these two songs.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know what the thought was behind it. I don't know if we do know the thought behind it,
I don't know. I've not found anything on it. If anyone knows anything about it, I'd love to read about that.
Yeah. I can't get enough.
I mean, in some ways, like, you're a vegetarian, so this is worse for you. You know, I eat meat, so...
That's true. Oh, man. But Ian Lowe, I'm sure those words are in Ian Lowe's version too. It's the sister's version that I sing myself. Yes. But Ian Lowe, I'm sure it's in there. And what's interesting is that Ian Lowe is kind of in that song... There's an image of him kind of covering over the bodies, and which wasn't the kind of like male role in that. Which, and I think you before we started recording, you'd kind of mentioned that he is known for that kind of female.
Yeah, it's been noted that this song he composed is kind of very feminine in its language, mm-hmm. and kind of adopting that role as the woman lamenting mm-hmm. over the bodies. But you know, you contrast that with La in Your Lochy, which is much more kind of stoic and like manly, and I talk in a historical sense of poetry and political commentary. So yeah, it's just really interesting that kind of that feminine side of the poetry coming through and him adopting that kind of womanly mourning in his poetry.
I wonder what it was about those murders that changed his style a little bit and his, well, I suppose his reaction to the...
Yeah, that he took it so strongly that he was hell-bent on avenging those murders.
Like... Was his father clan chief? Was he Keppoch? Was his? I wonder if his father was like a Keppoch chief as well. But he was. Now what's it called? Abdicate? No, is that when you choose?
Choose to kind of step down.
I don't know if he chose. I'm sure he was forced. I'm going to look it up.
Okay,
actually.
Let's look it up.
Ian Lowe.
I was just seeing if I had something on it there. He's MacDonald of Keppoch. Like he's certainly in the hierarchy.
His grandpa was Ian Aldhain, who was a chief of Keppoch, but deposed. I think deposed means he was forced to. Deposed meaning. Hold on.
I've been doing a lot of that.
Yeah.
What does deposed mean?
Yeah, removed from office suddenly or forcefully.
Oh.
So I think his grandpa, maybe not his dad, it says descendant, but I'm sure it was close descendant, otherwise I don't think I would know.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if, because he was a descendant of a previous chief of Keppoch, he had some sort of emotional trauma. And his grandpa, I'm guessing, was Ian Aldhain. So I wonder if he just thought, well, he and his grandpa was forced to step down from the being chief. So I wonder if he was just like, well, my grandfather was forced and now these young boys have been killed. It might have been something to...
He seems to have had a strong sense of injustice and kind of a moral compass. If you can...
It's funny, is it? Because we do kind of... Kill seven people. We do like... glorify Ian Lowe, but he did behead seven people. He was a good guy. He was a great guy. It's funny,
it's the characters
that were like, yeah, he was one of the good guys. And then you're like, oh, yeah, look what he did.
Yeah.
What were the others doing?
Seven's the quota. Seven's fine. After that.
And he washed their heads, to be fair.
Yep.
It was good of him.
Nobody likes sloppy table manners.
No.
Right, so I've just, my brain's gone on a wee bit of a tangent. This brings me to something, right? Mm-hmm. I pre-warned you that I might bring this up, but I didn't quite tell you what I was going to speak about. It's an idea that kind of jumps around my head from time to time. And I don't really have any answer to it, but it's when do we as a society forgive history? Or have we? So I kind of, you know, if my brothers had been murdered, or you know, I don't forgive very easily.
Yeah. Oh no, I'm with you.
I really don't. And
oh, I hold a grudge.
I'm quite happy to admit that.
I've got them all marked down.
Yeah. My 7 on the hit list.
Yeah.
Right. I really don't. But if that had happened, or anything near that level of trauma in my life, and heaven forbid, I really hope it doesn't, I'm never going to forgive somebody who has done that.
No.
So at what point do we as a society today go, that's a brilliant story, you know, and actually where do the fierce hatred, when did that kind of dissipate? Does our kind of baseline for historical events just over hundreds of years, just our baseline of what is right and what, you know, does it just shift ever so slightly over hundreds of years to kind of forget and forgive?
It's hard, isn't it? Because the experiences that we have now, we couldn't even try to understand living in the 1600s. But there are things that have happened in the last couple of hundreds of years that still have an impact on us negatively.
Mm-hmm.
So it is hard to move on from history at sometimes. Mm-hmm. But for example, just the story that we've just been talking about, although most of my family are from Lochaber, so there is chances that we are maybe descendants of the same mm-hmm. area.
Yeah.
But I am so far removed from that I can't even imagine feeling anger towards certain characters or certain groups within a clan. Like, that's not, I don't have any affiliation to clan history. And that seems like a really bizarre thing to say for a Highlander, mm-hmm. and especially one who speaks Gaelic and who loves the history and the songs and the culture, but it's not our world. And I think there are certain people across the world who really attach themselves to clan history. And I think that's really nice that people can trace their family line, and they can tell you that their great-grandfather was chief of whatever, and like, that's great. But it's not ever something that, if I was told that, I couldn't relate to that person because I'm so far removed.
So far removed.
So for that, and like, the thought of having to forgive certain behaviours that long ago is like, well, that's not even in my mind. Mm-hmm. But there are things that have happened in the Highlands and Islands, like the clearances.
Yeah, exactly.
It's really hard for us to let go of that because the incredible impact that's had on us and still has on us today.
And I think as well, when you sing the songs, you've got that even more, or just know of the songs, you've got that insight into real people's experiences and responses and trauma through that. So it connects you, in the way that we can.
Yeah.
Like you said, we can't let go of it. The Highlands were traumatized.
Oh, horrific. It is, and there's so much that has happened to the Highlanders and the Islanders that we don't know what our culture would be like today had they not happened. Like, we know that the Highlanders were put to the front line in the war.
Yeah,
we lost more soldiers than I think in any other regiment mm-hmm. put together mm-hmm. in the UK.
Yeah,
and it's when you see those pictures of before the Highlanders left and when they came back, it's like, it gives me shivers thinking about it.
Yeah.
Like, it's so horrific. And then the clearances, people being forced to leave their land. There's accounts in Skye where it wasn't even that their houses were just burned and they were thrown off. They were asked to take the bricks from their house and like unbuild their home.
Oh,
like the trauma.
So demoralizing.
It's like that was their whole life and they were forced to leave. And like, would Gaelic be in a better state? Yes.
Yes.
Like, we can certainly say it would be.
Yeah.
Would maybe the housing crisis be as bad in the Highlands? Probably not.
Absolutely not.
Because we would have ownership of our own land.
Like,
there's so much stuff that
That we can does still impact us.
Because it has an impact on us.
I wonder as well, with the song that we were just talking about, that was kind of pre-Culloden. Mm-hmm. And I wonder whether after Culloden there was kind of, you know, and the disbandment of the clans. Mm-hmm. And then Culloden happened. It was almost like it switched to this kind of collective trauma that everyone was experiencing mm-hmm. the same thing. So rather than clan conflicts, it suddenly became, oh, we're all going through this, and it was kind of a shift in mindset perhaps that kind of put those kind of grievances from the clan conflicts previously mm-hmm. to rest a bit and new challenges were faced.
Well, that's it. That's how we'll mark this then. Pre-Culloden, we can forgive. Post-Culloden, yous are all screwed. We're still holding our grudges.
Kim, you really don't forgive.
I'm kidding.
We can think of it. Yeah.
That's the new moral code.
Okay, I like it. I'll stick with that. Cool.
So on to our next murder.
Well, I was just before we do that, would you sing a bit of the song for us? Would you be up for singing?
Yeah, of course. So this is the version from the sister, Mersna Kepi. So it goes in. Yeri chemische mochitoni, hoiro nachelrin yoro, hei mieren te dich voi, famolende yoho. Dein Kanuan lat das Kachtevschiff verarren mogel se ochon. Sleck mi erin terug vronog, hoiro nach hilrin joro, chne mi tei ma hirken chode, fa molende ochon. Dein Kanu lat das Kachtevschiff verarren mogeise ochon.
Oh.
It's so sad, isn't it?
Oh, it's beautiful.
Oh, it is. It's a gorgeous, gorgeous melody.
Mm-hmm. I don't think I'd heard it being sung before you.
Well, it's actually, I can't quite remember where I first heard it. I think it was on Tobar and Dolgish. But I must have subconsciously known it. I actually, she probably wouldn't thank me for it, but I've got a voice note on my phone from years and years and years ago. I was drinking lovely wine with Kathleen McInnes. And she...
That's the start of a very good story.
Yeah, exactly. And she sang a few songs into my phone, and I don't know if I've actually ever used any of them, but they were all the way Kathleen could make anything sound just incredible. Mm-hmm. And when I was doing this album, I typed into my voice notes Mersna Kepi because I wanted to find a previous rehearsal recording to check something, and then up popped Mersna Kepi from, like, I don't know, 2015 or 16. I was like, I've just learned this song in the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. And I clicked on it, and there's Kathleen singing it on my phone. It's a wee bit different to the way I sing it, but I was like, oh, that's funny, I heard this years ago and I just didn't remember that it was the same story. But she had a slightly different melody to it, and it's gorgeous. So there must be quite a few versions.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, there always is.
That's the way it transmits, doesn't it? Yeah, it gets passed on differently, and you find your own interpretations. Mm-hmm. But it's beautiful the way you sing it. And
do you know, the song, the track, the way we recorded it is in two parts. So we let it have its moment of, oh, this is really sad. And there's hardly any, in fact, there's no rhythm in, from instruments. It's just the spoken rhythm. Mm-hmm. And then we're like, well, it's just such a nice melody that actually, by the end of the song, it sounds very happy and uplifting. There's probably people are turning in their graves that we've done this to their story. But it's just such a gorgeous melody. We're like, a little bit of light, people.
They're going to be turning even more when they hear this podcast and we're laughing.
I know.
Yeah. Oh no, it's beautiful. And it's just got one of these melodies that just sticks in your head. It's just, it pierces you.
It's so nice. It's a great melody.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Mm. Wow, what a horrible story.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing it so eloquently. Oh, gorgeous. Right, I feel like, well, we can take a tiny wee breath and then get stuck into some more gore. I'm quite excited actually because the song that I've chosen, you have a link to, because it's kind of, you say your family's from Lochaber, but your family lives now in Glenlyon, yes?
Yeah, so my mum and my stepdad moved there when I was maybe 18. Uh-huh. And I'd never heard of Glenlyon before they moved. I went away travelling with my sister to Southeast Asia for maybe 4 months, and we came back and they'd moved from Oban, where we were born and raised, and to this place we'd never heard of. We're like, oh, great. Oh. Now none of us have bedrooms at home, but it is one of the most stunning...
That's an insult.
But one of the most stunning parts of Scotland I've ever been to. It's gorgeous.
I don't know it too well, and it's actually somewhere that... I can never figure out, like, I can't quite figure out the roads around there, Killin and all around. I'm like, it's a black hole on the map of Scotland for me.
Yeah, it's been just over 10 years and I know how to get to and from, but I couldn't tell you whereabouts they are on the map.
Okay.
I'm like, okay, I know Killin's a 45 minute drive because it's the closest co-op. Like, that's all I know.
Well, it's certainly, although we don't really know where it is, it is a part of the country that has a huge amount of history. And maybe a bit, I don't know, it's a part of the country that's not hugely associated with Gaelic songs now, or you can counter me on that.
Well, yeah, I think you're right. I think there's not any natives anymore there. There's, mm-hmm. In fact, I would say I feel like quite confident to say there is no natives anymore.
Wow.
But there is actually a huge Gaelic history in Glenlyon that people will know it, but it's not widely known.
No, it's not kind of regarded as the Gaelic strongholds. And
it's not, but it was for it was for a long time.
Very important. Mm-hmm. So, Glenlyon or Glenstray, is that along the road from it? This is kind of where we're going to set the scene for the next song. We're going to step back about 100 years before Muirsnakepi. Mm-hmm. And we are going to look at a song that is widely known across the Gaeltacht and across the world. It's a song that has survived one of the longest surviving songs in
It's the oldest.
Yeah. And something that really amazed me with this song, it survived an oral tradition for almost 250 years before it was first documented in a manuscript. Amazing. And I just love that.
The power of oral tradition.
Yeah. So it's a really, a powerful song, a hugely gory story behind it. And just testament to... It's important, and people obviously wanted to keep singing it and passing it on because it was really significant. Mm-hmm. And it is, I'm sure many people will have guessed already. If you don't know already, it's Greek-O-Cria, as it is affectionately known. And this is a lullaby / lament, kind of forms a dual purpose. That was composed by Mór Chaimbeár, Marian Campbell, and she was the wife of Grieger. And she was also the daughter of Duncan Campbell of Glenlyon. So this story brings together Campbells and MacGregors, which, spoiler alert, didn't go very well.
Those Campbells.
Those Campbells, I know. Sorry if you're a Campbell listening, but, you know, it's all right, we've forgiven history. It was exactly, before Culloden.
Exactly.
You're off the hook. So I find this fascinating because I find the whole Campbell history quite confusing, and all the conflicts that ensued with particularly Campbell's and McDonald's and coal massacre and whatnot. But perhaps one of the most persecuted clans was the MacGregors. And they, just as a very brief note on the MacGregors, they were outlawed and they had to renounce their name if you were found to be a MacGregor. You know, people would kill you. Mm-hmm. And so they adopted differently. Apparently, wait, I might have got confused, but I think some of them adopted Graham as a surname.
Oh, really?
So, you know, I'm Team MacGregor.
Great. Doesn't work out well for you.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. But we're still singing about it.
Yeah, sure.
I'm just claiming this as a Graham song.
Yeah, great.
I'm really bad for that. Like, just, and I'll just twist that tiny bit of information and make it my own. But so the there's, it's well documented that there was a lot of conflict between the Campbells and the MacGregors. But there was a period just before the events of the song where there was relative peace. And my understanding of it is that, yeah, so for 130 years prior to the events of 1570, there was a bit of relative peace. So in 1513, the MacGregors kind of acted as vassals. I had to Google that word. Vassals of the Campbell chiefs. So they kind of were a bit subservient to them. They kind of worked in partnership with them, but the Campbells had the authority over them. But after 1513, the Campbells of Glenlyon, or sorry, Campbells of Glenorchy, so they were kind of the overarching, and Glenlyon came under their banner, I believe. So post 1513, the Campbells of Glenorchy, they kind of, they started to fall apart a wee bit. They were losing their prominence and went into a bit of decline. And so the MacGregors of Glenstrae along the road, their affiliation to the Campbells were redirected by the Earl of Argyll to Ian Campbell of Cawdor. So they would... The Campbells of Glenorchy were a bit displeased about this, but there wasn't too much they could do about it. However, fast forward 40 years, 1550, Colin Leah, or Colin Leah, grey-haired, I suppose, another colour.
Yeah.
he became the clan chief of the Campbells of Glenorchy. And so under his leadership, they rose to prominence again. And he had his eyes set on the MacGregors of Glenstrae. So if you're still with me, so the MacGregors of Glenstrae had kind of been redirected to Cawdor, and here they were, Callan Leah of Glenorchy, trying to regain control over the MacGregors. And so they went on the offensive again, the Campbells. And although the measures that they took were pretty barbaric, they were legal, and they kind of to ensure that the MacGregors could come under their under their wing.
Yeah.
That sounds too nice.
Yeah.
So they kind of enacted a lot of threatening behaviours, and conflicts began again. So Callan Leah, the clan chief of the Campbells, he kind of pressed the MacGregors to accept bonds of manrent.
Yeah. I know that one.
Bonds of manrent, which I'm not quite sure exactly what that means, but I think it's that kind of ensuring that loyalty and having that kind of control over them. And in order to do this, he disposed of an important member of Clan MacGregor. He persuaded the Earl of Argyll to reassign the services of the MacGregors to himself. And he, I've got this in quotes, purchased the superiority of Glenstrae and the ward and marriage of Greeker Ruaidh. So Greeker Ruaidh is our main character, Greek O'Crea here. And he was the young clan chief of the MacGregors. And so the age is actually quite important because Greeker was, he became the clan chief at a very, he was just his coming of age. And so he was very young and inexperienced. And so Cailín Laoire kind of took advantage of this to try and regain control of the MacGregors. In 1562, Greeker Ruaidh, red-haired Gregor, that's when he assumed the leadership of the MacGregors of Glenstrae. And Cailín Laoire, who'd been, when did he come into power again? I've already forgotten that date. 1550. So 12 years as the Campbell chief. He tried to take advantage of the fact that Greeker was so young and inexperienced, and he made him an ultimatum. And that was that the MacGregors of Glenstrae would be allowed their homeland again. They could have, you know, because it wasn't really theirs. It was kind of under the bonds of manrent.
Yeah.
So they could regain the control of their lands again. However, it came at a cost, and that was that they had to surrender to Clan Campbell. He had to give up two of his clansmen that had recently killed some of the Campbell servants. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. You know. So Greeker had this choice to make whether he, you know, what was more important, the kind of the lands that had been in the MacGregor family for years, centuries probably, or you know, but at that cost, could he give up people? Could he, could he do that? And it would compromise his leadership and his authority. So, you know, was he prepared to give up that kind of status and whatever he was working towards as a chief? You know, it's a bit of a quandary. What would you do, Kim?
I'd take the land.
No kidding. Throw the others under the bus.
Yeah. I don't know.
It's lovely land there.
Yeah, rock and a hard place, isn't it?
It is, really. So, this ultimatum had a deadline of the 1st of January, 1563. And so he came with his response a little bit earlier. So on the 7th of December, 1562, with a few weeks to go before the deadline, he responded by attacking the Campbells.
Oh, yeah. Sure. Yeah.
That's it.
Makes sense.
Yeah. So he attacked the Campbells in two attacks. So the Campbells were returning from a fair in Perthshire. And the first attack, he set fire to an inn. And he killed eight men that were in the inn. I don't think he was alone. Some of his clansmen came with him. And in the second attack, which I believe was later on that night, they fired a barn. And I don't know whether the men in the barn perished in the fire or whether they were captured. I'm not quite sure what happened to them. So basically all hell broke loose.
Yeah.
And that's when that period of that 130 years went. Yeah, game over. Let's get back to battling.
Yeah.
So this intense conflict kind of reared its head again between the Campbells and MacGregors. And there was a moment's kind of relative peace for a couple of years, maybe 4 or 5 years, between, when was that, 1562, the 7th of December 1562, and 1570, when Grieger was beheaded. So, the story takes a bit of a Romeo and Juliet twist. So you've got your different clans and you've got a love story in the middle of this. And Grieger was, in by all accounts, a very loving relationship as opposed to a marriage of duty or anything like that.
You have to wonder what she was thinking about all of this back in 62. It's like, come on, yeah. Grieger, that's my family.
That's my family, but yeah. Also, come on, Dad. Uncle Callum.
Well, yeah,
Uncle
totally.
Callum.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
Yeah. I mean, she needed that outpouring of grief, didn't she? She needed the songs to process a lot.
Yeah.
So she was the daughter, did I say already, of Dunachich, Dunachich Campbell. And he was the uncle and close ally of Callan Leah, the clan chief of Campbells. So she's really caught in the middle of this. But she apparently, she composed another song previous to Grieg Ó Criath, and possibly a third song as well. But there's an earlier song, Rí Gur Mór Muchúid Fúlach, which she is kind of expressing her frustration and rage at not being allowed to marry Grieger. So, it was definitely a love story between them, but her father had, or whoever in the clan, I don't know if it would have been her father or whoever, forbade their relationship and didn't allow them to marry. Now, I mentioned a couple of years of relative peace.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, she was then allowed to marry Grieger, and they did. Although I'm a little bit confused because I was looking up what marriage was like in Scotland in the 16th century. And there were certainly marriages, like official marriages within clans, but also there was no legalities, like no, you know, it wasn't a legal document, you know, there was the contract, just a verbal contract. So I wondered whether they had got married
out with that
kind of political spectrum, and whether they had just married themselves. But I don't know.
Yeah, I suppose we won't either.
No, we weren't there.
No.
So yeah, this earlier song kind of suggests that there was definitely a very kind of intense relationship between them. And so then at some point, she did marry Grieger. I mean, yeah, like you're saying, what must she have been thinking, you know, just to... There's blood on both sides there, you know, each side killing each other, revenge attacks, left, right and centre. It's just, it's pretty, it's actually, I don't know, maybe you could think of it as like, it's quite strong on her part to see past that and actually genuinely, you know, any pettiness aside, and it's, I mean, it's a bit worse than pettiness, but to kind of...
But relatively, like, it's so hard to, we can't compare, like, what pettiness, like maybe it was petty then. Like, there was so much going on that it was just like, oh, it's life.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, there's, yeah, it takes a strong character. But it's also so nice to hear those stories of like true love back then, because they're few and far between, really.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh no, it's really sad.
It is really sad. It's a really sad story.
There's a thought that perhaps the fact that she was refused marriage to Grieger initially could have been part of the reason that Grieger so viciously responded to Callan Leah's ultimatum, because he was raging.
Yeah, fair.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. So there's a lot of pent up emotion here, and it's coming out in the most drastic and upsetting of ways. However, they did marry and they had two sons together. So they had Alistair Ruig and Ian Thu. So
more colours.
More colours. Mm-hmm. And so Alistair Ruig, their firstborn son, was and he was really young when Grieger was captured. In August 1569. And he was captured by a group of Campbells that included his father-in-law. So, you know, that's just, it's so messed up.
Yeah.
So messed up. You know, how were the minds just changed so often? Yes, you can't marry her. Yes, you can marry her. Right, I'm capturing you now. You know, but he was captured by the Campbells and he was held captive for 8 months. And during those 8 months, the Campbells were kind of trying to get permission from the Scottish Crown to execute him. And the dates kind of conclude, well, if he was held captive for 8 months. They reckon Marian must have got pregnant just before he was captured. And that the second son was born just after he was beheaded.
Oh, that's heartbreaking.
It's awful. And there are different versions of the song. And some of them, the words say that the firstborn son was that present at the execution with Marian.
Yeah, I've read that.
And he was sitting on his mother's knee, and she watched him being beheaded by her family.
I know, it's
incomprehensible.
It is, and just from her perspective of that's her father and her brother was involved,
I think so, yeah.
And it's that they are taking away the father of her children,
yeah,
her unborn children, and the love of her life, like, that she fought to marry. Like, it's so, like, how did she continue? Like, what was her place then in that society where she didn't have her own family to turn to?
Well, she married again.
Oh, she was fine. Let's stop worrying about mode.
Mode. No, but she married very unhappily.
No.
So her family, the Campbell family, then married her off to somebody within a guy, and he's referred to in the song as the Baron.
Oh, yes, of course. Sorry, yes. I know the story.
That was apparently just identified more recently, though, who this Baron was, and they think that's who she married again, and it would have been a bit of a safe marriage, mm-hmm, for the family, for the Campbell family, and to kind of deal with her and, you know, her and her children, mm-hmm, to kind of, I don't know, like, keep her silent, maybe, I don't know, just keep her from rebelling and marrying another MacGregor. And yeah, she's, Robert Menzies of Comrie was the name of the Baron, the Baron Crian Adalach, which is mentioned in the song. And yeah, you see how, you know, like we talked at the beginning about lullabies and just that kind of very vulnerable state. I mean, there's a woman who's heavily pregnant and has a child, a very young child, with all of the conflict that went on before, with the, like you say, the fighting for that love story, to actually be present. And because I love a dramatic story, I like to believe that version.
Yeah.
To experience all of that, like, the song Grieg Eo Criach just gushes, mm-hmm, out, just a huge outpouring of grief. There's some words in it, I mean, there's some really graphic descriptions in it. There's a verse that talks about his head, his beheaded head, and they put it on a stopdarich, they put it like on a fence post. Mm-hmm. Just, again, like the heads on Leith Walk.
Yeah.
You know, just that warning almost of, you know.
It's the verse that talks about when all the other women of the village are sleeping at night, she goes to his grave and she'll be there just like
pounding her hands. Yeah. And just.
Oh, it's so visual there.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so strong, that image.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there's another verse she talks about. That one's a really powerful voice, like just pounding her hands. And some versions have it that she's pounding the bed, like she can't sleep from her torment. But yeah, some of them have it that she's gone to his grave and she's just,
just the fury, you know, when you feel the anger, that combination of like anger and upset when you aren't able to distinguish them, like it comes across so strongly in that song. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so she composed this song, and that I think this is possibly one of the darkest lullabies that we have, you know, just they've taken the children's father away, and the children can never know their father. They can never. Oh,
yeah.
It's trauma for them as well. Mm-hmm. You know, it's trauma for an unborn child. Like, yeah, from day one, they are left with this awful situation.
Yeah. The generational trauma that they didn't know they had. Oh. They were like, it's insane.
Yeah. There's a verse that said, Sketami gunulanakum ulan ulikach samhamul kuri green as cool the heen rilad, which is, though now I have no apples and others have them all. I just love this kind of this metaphor of apples and that sweetness and that sweet love, you know. My own apple, fragrant, handsome, and the back of his head on the ground. And you're just, so as well as all the grief and the torment, there's beauty in there as well, and all these gorgeous metaphors kind of coming through the song as well. It's it's really awful. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing we have that account from a woman's perspective from hundreds and hundreds of years ago.
Yeah.
And there's a couple of lullaby versions, but one of the most common versions is just a lament. It's not a lullaby. And for that to have survived and to be listened to is so incredible. We're getting a real insight.
Yeah. I don't want to say that we are lucky to have it, but lucky sounds too positive in these circumstances. But it's, again, it kind of comes back to that, like, support network talk about with women. And I read there's an amazing essay on this by Virginia Blankenhorn. It's like 46 pages long. I love it. And she really analyzes in great depth kind of the different versions and the different words and the different melodies that exist of it and how it was transmitted. And and I think it's her that suggests that, you know, somebody might have overheard it just in the house and then gone back to their own families and started that chain of passing it on.
I mean, it must have been the way. Mm-hmm. There's different versions of, I mean, all songs, but I think with Grigal Cria, it is known that some of them are from the Southern Isles.
Yeah,
some
I love
of them
this.
Are from the Northern Isles. And it's like, well, how did the stories and the melodies change so much? So it's just been overheard and then passed. And so like the Bada version.
She's got a whole table about that.
Oh, does she?
Yeah, she analyzes it. It's amazing.
I should read this 46 page essay.
It's really, really cool. Yeah. And she's looked at all the different versions on Topur and Dulchish and looked at their localities, and there's a distinct difference between Skye, Lewis and Harris version, which are all most closely linked to the Francis Tolmie collection.
Yeah, okay.
So Francis Tolmie, that beautiful collection of songs from Skye, and the kind of contributors were from those areas. And then a lot of overlap, more similar than they are different, with Uists and Barra and Southern Hebrides. Mm-hmm. And that came more closely linked to, I think, the MacDonald collection. I don't remember. The Tolmie collection, the one from probably being from Skye, that's most likely that's what I would have heard. But there are anomalies as well, and there are some kind of Perthshire contributors in Tobar an Dulchais which is lovely, but whether it's accurately represents what was, what did come originally out of Perthshire or not, you know, it's, yeah. We're hundreds of years later.
It is a shame. The thing with Perthshire is that, I mean, I'm sure there'll be natives across Perthshire, but that part, Glen Lyon, where this kind of has its home, it is such a shame that that history is now just history. It's not continuing. There's nobody there to continue those stories and that tradition. There is some still gorgeous traditions there. In fact, that I think the longest pagan tradition that we still, like Celtic pagan tradition that we still have, that's been uninterrupted, is there. But it is being carried on by people who aren't native, and which is totally fine. But like, it's gone from there, so it's hard to get those like Perthshire accounts of these stories now, because well, who do you go to?
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. Mm-hmm. Will you sing a wee bit with me?
Yeah.
Lovely. Okay. I think this is the Tall Me version. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like you say, the other beautiful versions, Cathy Ann McPhee.
Stunning. Oh, yeah, hers is gorgeous.
Gorgeous.
That's definitely one of the lullaby versions.
Yeah, one of the lullabies, yeah, with Baba Milenov. Yeah. Yeah, it's beautiful. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's go heavy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Semagaich eliwch ys hyrym Si chan a siach chian Ief y grig y gos y grigan Rys yn gafin dian O fan, o fan, o fan iri O fan iri o fan o fan
O
fan iri Smor mo fla smor I ta fôr y llwag yn dowyn Gorstietu lunge Surya the chow ner stop tari Tachken beg for tre O van, o van, o van yiri O van yiri What have we learnt?
Oh, history's dark and there's a lot of murder.
Yeah, and we love it. In a really respectful way.
Yeah, yeah. This is it. This is a new podcast strand of just murder. It's like my favourite Gaelic murder.
Yes. I guess we learn the power of the oral tradition and how important it was to people and continues to be to carry these songs, because these things happened. They really, you know, they're such personal accounts, and it's obviously at the time was incredibly important to carry those voices forward. And the fact that they survive now in our big kind of international world and with all our distractions of modern life as we know it at the moment, it's still important. You know, it survives and it still impacts us. So I think that importance of carrying these songs on kind of strikes me in this.
Oh, totally. And I think, you know, our culture is one of many that have a very strong and powerful oral tradition. But what a special thing to look back in history through songs and stories,
mm-hmm.
and to have a personal experience of a devastating, traumatic event, or sometimes an incredibly happy event that should be celebrated, to have those accounts from normal people and from the well-educated bards. It's we're so, no matter the sadness that comes with it and the graphic horror,
mm-hmm.
not every culture has that, and we're so lucky that we get to hear what it was like for people hundreds of years ago and learn our history through art.
That's beautiful. Oh, well, thank you, Kim.
Oh, thank you so much.
I want to talk more.
This episode will be 3 hours long.
I know, I'm looking at the time going, this is a big one. But no, thank you hugely for your knowledge and your dark sense of humour.
Yeah, blame my mother.
Yeah. And for a lovely chat. And it's been a total pleasure. And for singing.
Yeah. Oh, well, it's been lovely to share that with you. Join you in song, so thank you. What a thank.
Share the bear. A huge thanks to Kim for one of the most fun conversations I've had on Gaelic Song Stories. Kim's singing of Muirs na Cepaigh can be found on her beautiful album And So We Gather, available to buy or download on Bandcamp and to stream on all the usual platforms. I hope that you enjoyed our conversation. If so, please remember to like, share, review and subscribe to this podcast. It really does make a world of difference. The music you hear is taken from my album Urunta, which is available through my website www.deirdregraham.com, as well as on the usual streaming platforms. Before I go, I'd like to extend my grateful thanks to the Tasklich Fund from Fashion and Gael for supporting this series. I am delighted to have brought to you another 6 episodes of Gaelic Song Stories over the last few weeks. My most sincere thanks go to the 6 wonderful contributors who brought so much energy and generosity to these conversations. And also thanks to you for listening, for playing each episode and sharing them widely. It really means the world to me. I look forward to sharing the next series of Gaelic Song Stories with you another time. Chun an uair sin, bhean ach glaive.